She stood still. She looked as if she were seeing not the room around her, but the scene in Colorado. Her sudden movement had the abruptness of a convulsion. With the single-tracked rationality of a somnambulist, she whirled to find her handbag, as if it were the only object in existence. She seized it, she whirled to the door, and ran. "Dagny," he screamed, "don't go back." The scream had no more power to reach her than if he were calling to her across the miles between him and the mountains of Colorado. He ran after her, he caught her, seizing her by both elbows, and he cried, "Don't go back, Dagny. In the name of anything sacred to you, don't go back." She looked as if she did not know who he was. In a contest of physical strength, he could have broken the bones of her arms without effort. But with the force of a living creature fighting for life, she tore herself loose so violently that she threw him off balance for a moment. When he regained his footing, she was running down the hill, running as he had run at the sound of the alarm siren in Reardon's Mills, running to her car on the road below. His letter of resignation lay on the desk before him, and James Taggart sat staring at it, hunched by hatred. He felt as if his enemy were this piece of paper, not the words on it, but the sheet and the ink that had given the words a material finality. He had always regarded thought and words as inconclusive, but a material shape was that which he had spent his life escaping, a commitment. He had not decided to resign. Not really, he thought. He had dictated the letter for a motive which he identified to himself only as just in case. The letter, he felt, was a form of protection, but he had not signed it yet, and that was his protection against the protection. The hatred was directed at whatever had brought him to feel that he would not be able to continue extending this process much longer. He had received word of the catastrophe at 8 o'clock this morning. By noon, he had arrived at his office. An instinct that came from reasons which he knew but spent his whole effort on not knowing had told him that he had to be there this time. The men who had been his marked cards, in a game he knew how to play, were gone. Clifton Losey was barricaded behind the statement of a doctor who had announced that Mr. Losey was suffering from a heart condition, which made it impossible to disturb him at present. One of Taggart's executive assistants was said to have left for Boston last night, and the other was said to have been called unexpectedly to an unnamed hospital, to the bedside of a father nobody had ever suspected him of having. There was no answer at the home of the chief engineer. The vice president in charge of public relations could not be found. Driving through the streets to his office, Taggart had seen the black letters of the headlines. Walking down the corridors of Taggart Transcontinental, he had heard the voice of a speaker pouring from a radio in someone's office, the kind of voice one expects to hear on unlighted street corners. It was screaming demands for the nationalization of the railroads. He had walked through the corridors, his steps noisy, in order to be seen, and hasty in order not to be stopped for questions. He had locked the door of his office, ordering his secretary not to admit any person or phone call, and to tell all comers that Mr. Taggart was busy. Then he sat at his desk, alone with blank terror. He felt as if he were trapped in a subterranean vault, and the lock could never be broken again, and as if he were held on display in the sight of the whole city below, hoping that the lock would hold out for eternity. He had to be here in this office. It was required of him. He had to sit idly and wait, wait for the unknown to descend upon him and to determine his actions. And the terror was both of who would come for him, and of the fact that nobody came. Nobody to tell him what to do. The ringing of the telephones in the outer office sounded like screams for help. He looked at the door with a sensation of malevolent triumph at the thought of all those voices being defeated by the innocuous figure of his secretary, a young man expert at nothing but the art of evasion, which he practiced with the gray rubber limpness of the amoral. The voices, thought Taggart, were coming from Colorado, from every center of the Taggart system, from every office of the building around him. He was safe, so long as he did not have to hear them. His emotions had clogged into a still, solid, opaque ball within him, which the thought of the men who operated the Taggart system could not pierce. Those men were merely enemies to be outwitted. The sharper bites of fear came from the thought of the men on the board of directors. But his letter of resignation was his fire escape, which would leave them stuck with the fire. The sharpest fear came from the thought of the men in Washington. If they called, he would have to answer. His rubber secretary would know whose voices superseded his orders. But Washington did not call. The fear went through him in spasms once in a while, leaving his mouth dry. He did not know what he dreaded. He knew that it was not the threat of the radio speaker. What he had experienced at the sound of the snarling voice had been more like a terror which he felt because he was expected to feel it, a duty terror, something that went with his position, like well-tailored suits and luncheon speeches. But under it, he had felt a sneaking little hope, swift and furtive like the course of a cockroach. If that threat took form, it would solve everything, save him from decision, save him from signing the letter. He would not be president of Tiger Transcontinental any longer, but neither would anyone else. Neither would anyone else. He sat looking down at his desk, keeping his eyes and his mind out of focus. It was as if he were immersed in a pool of fog, struggling not to let it reach the finality of any form. That which exists possesses identity. He could keep it out of existence by refusing to identify it. He did not examine the events in Colorado. He did not attempt to grasp their cause. He did not consider their consequences. He did not think. The clogged ball of emotion was like a physical weight in his chest, filling his consciousness, releasing him from the responsibility of thought. The ball was hatred. Hatred as his only answer. Hatred as the sole reality. Hatred without object, cause, beginning, or end. Hatred as his claim against the universe. As a justification, as a right, as an absolute. The screaming of the telephones went on through the silence. He knew that those pleas for help were not addressed to him, but to an entity whose shape he had stolen. It was this shape that the screams were now tearing away from him. He felt as if the ringing ceased to be sounds and became a succession of slashes hitting his skull. The object of the hatred began to take form, as if summoned by the bells. The solid ball exploded within him and flung him blindly into action. Rushing out of the room in defiance of all the faces around him, he went running down the halls to the operating department and into the anteroom of the operating vice president's office. The door to the office was open. He saw the sky and the great windows beyond an empty desk. Then he saw the staff in the anteroom around him and the blonde head of Eddie Willers in the glass cubbyhole. He walked purposefully straight toward Eddie Willers. He flung the glass door open, and from the threshold, in the sight and hearing of the room, he screamed, "Where is she?" Eddie Willers rose slowly to his feet and stood looking at Taggart with an odd kind of dutiful curiosity, as if this were one more phenomenon to observe among all the unprecedented things he had observed. He did not answer. "Where is she?" "I cannot tell you." "Listen, you stubborn little punk, this is no time for ceremony. If you're trying to make me believe that you don't know where she is, I don't believe you. You know it, and you're going to tell me, or I'll report you to the Unification Board. I'll swear to them that you know it. Then try and prove that you don't." There was a faint tone of astonishment in Eddie's voice as he answered, "I've never attempted to imply that I don't know where she is, Jim. I know it, but I won't tell you." Taggart's scream rose to the shrill, impotent sound that confesses a miscalculation. "Do you realize what you're saying?" "Why, yes, of course." "Will you repeat it?" he waved at the room. "For these witnesses?" Eddie raised his voice a little, more in precision and clarity than in volume. "I know where she is, but I will not tell you." "You're confessing that you're an accomplice who's aiding and abetting a deserter?"
"If that's what you wish to call it."
"But it's a crime. It's a crime against the nation. Don't you know that?"
"No."
"It's against the law."
"Yes."
"This is a national emergency. You have no right to any private secrets. You're withholding vital information. I'm the president of this railroad. I'm ordering you to tell me. You can't refuse to obey an order. It's a penitentiary offense. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Do you refuse?"
"I do."
Years of training had made Taggart able to watch any audience around him without appearing to do so. He saw the tight-closed faces of the staff, faces that were not his allies. All had a look of despair, except the face of Eddie Willers. The feudal serf of Taggart Transcontinental was the only one who seemed untouched by the disaster. He looked at Taggart with the lifelessly conscientious glance of a scholar, confronted by a field of knowledge he had never wanted to study. "Do you realize that you're a traitor?" yelled Taggart. Eddie asked quietly, "To whom?"
to the people. It's treason to shield a deserter. It's economic treason. Your duty to feed the people comes first above anything else whatever. Every public authority has said so. Don't you know it? Don't you know what they'll do to you?
Don't you see that I don't give a damn about that?
Oh, you don't? I'll quote that to the Unification Board. I have all these witnesses to prove that you said...
Don't bother about witnesses, Jim. Don't put them on the spot. I'll write down everything I said. I'll sign it, and you can take it to the board.